This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowain. Chimpanzees are our closest relatives and share more than 90% of our DNA. That has made them popular research subjects, but that could change. There's a bill in Congress, the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act, that would prohibit invasive research on chimpanzees and would send chimps in federal facilities to sanctuaries. Supporters of the legislation argue that it's unethical and unnecessary to use such intelligent and social animals for research. Critics counter that chimps play an important role in the development of vaccines and for the treatment of certain diseases. Today on Radio Times, we get both sides of that debate, and we begin with John Vandenberg. He's Chief Scientific Officer for the Texas Biomedical Institute. He's also Director of the Southwest National Primate Research Center. And John Vandenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John Vandenberg, why do we need chimps for research?
We need chimpanzees for research. In fact, because they are so closely related to humans, they are uniquely, together with humans, susceptible to certain viral diseases such as hepatitis B and hepatitis C. We cannot develop vaccines and drugs for these diseases as quickly without the use of chimpanzees as we can develop them with chimpanzees. And in fact, there are about 300,000 deaths per year from hepatitis C in the world and 600,000 deaths per year from hepatitis B. And we have got to stop these epidemics as quickly as we possibly can through all means of research.
And what kind of research is being done at the Southwest National Primate Research Center?
The principal area of research with chimpanzees involves the development of novel drugs for treating hepatitis C. Also some research on hepatitis B. We must develop these drugs because the existing drugs for treating hepatitis C are only effective in about half of the people who are infected with the virus. So we've got to have newer drugs, better drugs, and more effective drugs that can stop this virus before it mutates in response to the current drugs that we have.
And how do you actually use these chimpanzees?
These chimpanzees are infected with hepatitis C virus. Now, it's important to note they do not develop the disease. Humans develop the disease, hepatitis C. Chimpanzees don't develop the disease even though they're infected with the virus. Then we treat the chimpanzees with novel drugs and novel combinations of drugs in an effort to kill the virus in these chimpanzees and have the chimpanzee return to a normal state.
And do they live in cages? How do these chimpanzees live at this center?
These chimpanzees all live in social groups. None of them live in indoor cages. They all have indoor-outdoor facilities. The indoor facilities are, of course, heated in the wintertime. We have 5 full-time veterinarians, clinical veterinarians, who are available to care for these chimpanzees. They get a medical checkup once a year, more than most people do. They get a dental checkup. There are 5 full-time primate behaviorists who provide environmental enrichment for them. So they're living in excellent conditions and under the best of medical and dental care.
And what happens, I use this word retire, I wasn't sure what word to use, but what happens when, in a sense, you don't need a particular chimp anymore?
Our chimpanzees are maintained throughout their lives in their social groups, provided whatever medical support is necessary. If they become diabetic, for example, we give them insulin injections. They're trained to take these insulin injections. And they may not ever be needed for research again, although it's possible that a chimpanzee with diabetes, for example, might be needed to test a new gene therapy for diabetes before it's tested in human subjects. But they live out their natural lives in their social groups.
But how different from that is a chimpanzee living in a sanctuary?
It's actually very similar to a chimpanzee living in a sanctuary. Many of our housing facilities are similar or the same as those that are at sanctuaries. We actually have much greater capacity for medical care than sanctuaries do, because we have a large volume of monkeys as well as chimpanzees, so that enables us to have better medical facilities and a larger number of veterinarians and behaviorists on site. But the conditions, living conditions, are much the same at sanctuaries as they are at research institutions.
Let me quote from one of the authors of this Great Ape Protection Act. This is Senator Cantwell saying, "The bipartisan Great Ape Protection Act is a common sense reform to end needless pain and psychological harm to one of the animal kingdom's most highly developed animals, the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee is a poor model for illness research, and the vast majority of the 500 federally owned chimpanzees are just wasting away in research laboratories, resulting in millions of dollars of wasteful government spending." What's your response to that?
Well, there are several facets to that comment. Let me comment first on the spending. The Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act is clearly a misnomer in regard to cost savings, because the cost to the taxpayer will be dramatically increased if the chimpanzees that are now available for research are moved to sanctuaries. The National Institutes of Health has posted on its website that it spends $34 a day to keep a chimpanzee at a research facility and $44 a day to keep a chimpanzee at the National Chimpanzee Sanctuary. So that's a 30% increase in cost of maintaining chimpanzees at sanctuaries. In regard to his comments about chimpanzees suffering from pain, I point out that the research So, for example, we can inject a drug into them, as we do with people. We can give them a drug orally. We collect blood samples from them, as we do with people. These procedures are not painful. They're not onerous. And, in fact, the same procedures we use both in clinical research with human beings as well as in the clinic to treat human beings.
But human beings can give permission. You can talk to a human being and tell them what you are going to do to them. You can't do that with a chimpanzee.
Well, you can't do it with a small baby either. And so we treat the chimpanzees with the utmost of respect and reverence, and as we would treat a human baby or a retarded human who with whom we couldn't talk either. We are the guardians of these chimpanzees. We are the guardians of all animals that we use in research. And it is our ethical and moral responsibility to treat them with the utmost respect.
Well, let me quote from Jane Goodall, and I know our listeners know that she certainly is opposed to the use of chimpanzees in research, but she says, chimpanzees depend on close physical contact. They love their comforts. They like to stretch out on a nice soft bed of grass. They make their own choices all the time. None of these things can in any possible way be experienced by a laboratory chimp. Is she wrong?
The chimpanzees in research are housed in their social groups. They have indoor-outdoor facilities. They have climbing facilities, that is vertical height, an enormous amount of enrichment, both enrichment of objects and treats, but also enrichment involving games that they may play with their human caregivers. Our chimpanzees, whether they're in sanctuaries or in research facilities, and under much the same conditions in either, actually live a very good life. In fact, they live much longer than chimpanzees in the wild. Jane Goodall herself has recently stated that some of the troops of chimpanzees that she's studying are being decimated by the chimpanzee form of AIDS. Our chimpanzees in captivity get all of the immunizations that people get, the childhood immunizations. They have access to antibiotics, medical procedures if they're needed. Chimpanzees in the wild have a very, very difficult life. If they don't die of AIDS, they may die of Ebola or meat. So I would quite disagree with Jane Goodall. I would argue that the chimpanzees in captivity, whether in sanctuaries or research facilities in this country, have a much better life than the chimpanzees in the wild.
What about using computer models for research? Would that work with the kind of research that you're doing?
Well, we use computers to whatever extent is possible, and we use cell cultures to the extent that's possible. We would love it if we could do this research, develop vaccines and drugs with nothing but computer models or cell culture models. Research would, of course, be much less expensive, and it's very difficult to garner the money needed for this research. But it's just not possible. We don't know enough about human physiology to completely model the physiological system of human beings in order to develop drugs that will work against these viruses in a human condition. So much as we would love to eliminate the use of chimpanzees, these hundreds of thousands, nearly a million people dying every year from hepatitis, and less than 1,000 chimpanzees available for research, and at any given time, less than 30 of those chimpanzees actually being used in research.
The U.S., though, is one of, I think, one or two countries in the world that still uses chimps for research, making us a bit of an outlier.
It is one of two countries in the world that uses chimpanzees for research, but I point out that very few countries have ever used chimpanzees in research. So countries that have passed laws prohibiting the use of chimpanzees in research, by and large, have never used chimpanzees in research. They've never had the expertise and the capability of using chimpanzees. However, the scientists from those countries and the pharmaceutical companies from those countries have always come to the United States and used the chimpanzees and the expertises that we have here, and they continue to do so. Very recently, a panel of 102 scientists, hepatitis researchers from around the world, including 52 from other countries, sent a letter to the Institute of Medicine making the case for why chimpanzees continue to be needed for hepatitis research. And many of those scientists were from countries that have banned the use of chimpanzees in their countries. Yet the scientists of those countries come to the United States to do the research with chimpanzees, and the people in those countries, I can assure you, will be delighted when we do develop better treatments for hepatitis B and hepatitis C and a vaccine for hepatitis C from the use of chimpanzees in research.
Well, we are out of time, and I thank you, John Vandenberg, for joining us today on Radio Times and giving us one half of this argument about the use of chimpanzees in research. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's the Chief Scientific Officer for the Texas Biomedical Institute, and he's also Director of the Southwest National Primate Research Center. One of two guests in this first portion of Radio Times today, or the first two segments of Radio Times today, as we take a look and get reactions to the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act. And we have a second guest waiting in the wings, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Friends School Haverford, a Quaker co-educational preschool through 8th grade school in Haverford, Pennsylvania, minutes from Center City. Since 1885, Friends School Haverford has been committed to providing an education that inspires the imagination and challenges the intellect. Academic rigor, a micro-farm with egg-laying hens, and a social curriculum based on respect and kindness are just a few of the hallmarks of their program. Walk-in Wednesday tours every week at 9 a.m. Details at friendshaverford.org.
I'm Marty Moscoane, here to remind you that your support is vital to the health and future of WHYY. We get about half of our operating funds from you, and we thank you for your support. If you have never been a supporter, do so now. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. We cover just about everything on Radio Times, and today it's the Great Ape Show. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Film Festival supports WHYY. From October 20th through November 3rd, the Philadelphia Film Festival returns to the city for its landmark 20th anniversary. Featuring over 120 films and more than 200 screenings, the Philadelphia Film Festival delivers festival selections from Toronto, Sundance, Cannes, and more. Ticket information and a full schedule of screenings are available online at filmadelphia.org or by phone at 267-239-2941.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. There are more than 1,000 chimpanzees being kept in laboratories in the United States, and there's a bill in Congress. It's called the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act that would ban the use of chimps for medical research. We just said goodbye to our first guest, John Vandenberg, and joining us now is Brian Hare. He's a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University Center for Cognitive Neuroscience. He studies animals like chimpanzees, bonobos, and dogs to understand the evolution of the human mind. And Brian Hare, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you so much for the invitation.
You're very welcome. And I'll begin with a question that I put to our first guest. Do we need chimpanzees for medical research?
Well, I would have thought so. I actually, as an undergraduate, worked in a laboratory in Atlanta where chimpanzees were housed. I didn't do any invasive work, but I was indoctrinated to believe that chimpanzees are really important for medical research. And as somebody who has a 7.5-month-old daughter, I agree that animals are really important for research, and if necessary, we need to potentially use them to protect human health. But I just went and spoke at the National Academy of Sciences that had a big meeting to review the utility of chimpanzees in biomedical research, and it was amazing, and it made me a vocal supporter of this act because the world's experts in malaria and HIV and respiratory diseases and what are called monoclonal antibodies, they all stood up and said that chimpanzees are no longer needed. They never will be needed in the future. And in addition, there was experts in biodefense that said the same thing. There was a representative from GlaxoSmithKline, one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the country, and Genentech as well. And they actually have made public statements on their website that chimpanzees just are not necessary at this point moving forward because of the advances in technology. And then to address the specific...
Let me just stop you there. And it's sort of unfair to put a question to you that John Vandenberg answered, but the research that his lab is doing, or his research center is doing, is on hepatitis C and B. And he seems to believe that the chimpanzees are helping develop our understanding and obviously a treatment for this disease. You're saying it can be done in another way?
Well, there are two points here. One is that the regional centers, the laboratories that were created to study chimpanzees, they were not created to study Hep C. They were created to study lots and lots of different diseases because it's so expensive to do this research. And the idea was that chimpanzees were going to be really important because they're so closely related to us. And they're not useful at all. The only thing that they can make an argument for that it potentially might be important for is testing a Hep C vaccination if we ever develop one. And you can't even really use them for development of the vaccination because now there are what are called humanized mice that have been genetically engineered to have an immune system like a human, and they're much more effective, and that's what at the National Academy of Sciences, even many of the Hep C researchers were saying that, including the representative from GlaxoSmithKline, who, when they made their public statement they're not going to use chimpanzees anymore, they didn't stop studying and trying to find a vaccination for Hep C. They just think, as a private company, that they are going to have a much better chance to do this quicker using another model. So, I mean, the idea that it's going to be quick to use chimpanzees to do anything is a little bit farcical in the sense that we've been looking for a Hep C vaccine using chimpanzees for 24 years. So I don't understand how it's going to be quick. And it's just going to be expensive.
And I do want to get to some of the research that you have been doing, but do you think that chimpanzees who are being used in research are being mistreated? Or do you think that for them this is a traumatizing experience because of what is being done to them and because they are chimpanzees?
Well, as a scientist, we are obligated to efficiently and effectively use taxpayer money. and to cause as little suffering as possible. And that's actually enshrined in our welfare code. The welfare code could always be improved as we learn more about how animals suffer. Absolutely, and I think actually much of what Dr. Vandenberg said was thinly veiled in a disguise, trying to make people think that the chimpanzees in laboratories are actually quite happy. He even said that they're in a place that's as good as a sanctuary. And, I mean, that's just, I mean, on any measure, that is just not true. The minimum standards in the United States is to have a chimpanzee that in the wild requires 4,000 football fields. In the wild, where he said that they're not happy, it requires 4,000 football fields. In a laboratory, the minimum standard is 25 square feet. And there are many, many chimpanzees today that are still singly housed, living in 25 square feet. And I can tell you that when you live 60 to 70 years, if you think it's bad to, you know, be stuck in a hotel room, imagine being stuck in the bathroom, because that's what that's equivalent to. And these animals are big. They're, 150 pounds, sometimes as much as 200 pounds, and they can be 5 feet, 5 foot five. So these are very large animals. They live 60 to 70 years. And in the wild, now we know that they need, you know, acres and acres and acres of, primary tropical rainforest to be happy. And we're keeping them, our minimum standard in the United States is 25 square feet. So for him to say that, you know, many of the chimpanzees are in these nice corrals where they're in social groups, that's true. But those are the chimpanzees that actually aren't being used for anything. And this is another thing that he really didn't talk about, is that we have over 1,000 chimpanzees, but at any one time, only 20% are being used on any research at all. And so we have, you know, an incredible waste of money and resource going into something that's totally underutilized. And at the National Academy of Sciences, all the top experts across all these different areas said we just don't need these animals anymore.
And so do you think then, assuming the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act is passed, then that these chimpanzees can make it they can't be returned to the wild, I'm assuming, but can they survive and thrive in a sanctuary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the sanctuary we have in the United States is called Chimp Haven. And the other thing that Dr. Vandenberg failed to mention is that taxpayers actually only pay for part of the funding that goes to Chimp Haven, whereas we pay everything for the laboratory chimpanzees. So we're going to save tremendous amounts of money, and there are very precise estimates that have been made that over 10 years we're going to save $300 million by moving federally owned chimpanzees to sanctuaries where they can all live in a social group, and the minimum standard of having them in 25 feet is, obviously, you know, that would not even dawn as a possibility at a sanctuary. A sanctuary is more like a zoo. The whole goal of a sanctuary is to make sure the animals are happy and that they can retire in peace. And these are all animals who have spent decades contributing to medicine, and now they, you know, needed a chance to be retired. And that's actually our obligation as a researcher, that when we realize that we no longer need a species or a laboratory full of animals, it's our obligation to make sure that we go ahead and find a responsible way to deal with the resource we don't need anymore. And that's what we need to do for these animals.
And when Dr. Vandenberg talks about these chimpanzees being treated for diseases and illnesses, and that there are vets there, and that actually their health is perhaps better than other chimpanzees in the wild, is he right? Is he wrong? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's sort of equivalent to saying that prisoners in the United States prison system are healthier than you and me. I think psychologically you're dealing with animals that are almost as complex, as a 5 or 6 year old child. They have rich family bonds. They form alliances in the wild. In fact, their lives are so complicated that, you know, one of the most famous books about them is called Chimpanzee Politics, because, they live in a very sophisticated group situation. And, of course, just like any animal, they like to have some control over their environment. In a laboratory, they have no control. They are told what to do every day, and they have very few choices they can make relative to wild chimpanzees. So I can promise you that no chimpanzee would volunteer to be in a laboratory. They would all like to be in the wild. So it's just not factual.
And we should think of them as prisoners?
I don't know. Yeah. I think the main thing is that, what Dr. Vandenberg, I think, would probably characterize the situation as is really it's our human health versus animals. And I don't think that's actually right. I think there's a small group of researchers using an obsolete and extremely expensive resource. And what they're competing against is people's health, because the money we could save, the $300 million we can save over the next 10 years, that can be reinvested into research that actually could have a huge impact. And also, Dr. Vandenberg and people who are promoting or fighting against this, the Grade 8 Protection Cost Savings Act, they really are trying to pretend that this act is only about laboratory research. It's actually about more than that. It's about ending the use of pet chimpanzees, because in the United States, people are allowed to have pet chimpanzees, while in Africa, you're not. So it's really hypocritical that we have all this commercial trade in an endangered species. We're the only country where we don't consider chimpanzees in our country as endangered. So our African conservation colleagues, and of course when we're dealing with government ministries, we look incredibly hypocritical, and it's very difficult for us to protect the remaining wild populations. And then the other thing is that there's some pretense that the chimpanzees in laboratories are the only ones available for research, and that only medical research is what's going on. But it ends up that 95% of the research going on with chimpanzees is totally non-invasive. It's health research that actually benefits chimpanzees, so veterinary research that we can also learn about ourselves from. And then there's also research about their intelligence and about their lives in the wild and how we can save them. And so there's very little research that's affected by this. And it's actually a very small group of people that we're talking about who actually study chimpanzees, because in 1995, the NIH actually banned breeding chimpanzees. So this is over a decade ago. The NIH said we're not investing in chimpanzees anymore because they're not particularly useful and they're very expensive.
Brian, just let me just quickly reintroduce you, because I want to make sure listeners know who you are and what we're talking about.
Thank you, Marty. Sorry.
No problem. And I appreciate your enthusiasm for this topic. And we are getting opinions about the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act. We began with John Vandenberg. Brian Hare is with us. He's a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University Center for Cognitive Neuroscience. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm curious about the kind of work that you are doing, because I know that you do study chimps. You study them in African sanctuaries. What are you looking to understand?
Well, so instead of, I actually told you I started working in laboratories, and I realized that it was because of the ban on breeding and because I saw that these animals were really kind of suffering in these contexts, that I needed to find an alternative way to study them, because I just study their behavior and their intelligence and their cognition, like you say. And I realized that sanctuaries in Africa who provide lifetime care, and their main emphasis is on providing the best place for chimpanzees to live their life, these chimpanzees that live in these sanctuaries are orphans of the bushmeat trade. So unfortunately, people in Africa are killing chimpanzees and trying to sell them commercially, which we're trying to stop. So you can see, as an American, the fact that America uses chimpanzees in a commercial way makes this difficult. So we're trying to stop the commercial use that's actually illegal in Africa. And so my research in these sanctuaries with these sanctuary animals, actually all the research money that I generate goes to help these welfare and conservation organizations. And the last thing I want to say is Dr. Vandenberg actually argued that the biomedical labs are cheaper than sanctuaries. Well, you know, you can play some funny games with the U.S. sanctuary figures. I don't think he's probably being completely straightforward, because on the National Research Council website, it is $67 per day, from $40 to $67 per day, and he quoted a figure of $34. So I don't know where his numbers come from, because on the website from the institute that actually funds the research, it is stated as $40 to $67. So in the sanctuaries I work, it costs me, in Africa, it costs me one quarter per day, a U.S. quarter per day, to study a chimpanzee. That is 160 times cheaper for me to do the exact same research that what I guess Dr. Vandenberg would think that I should do in a laboratory. It is extremely cost-effective to abandon the laboratory system. And I just want to clarify that the idea of working in these laboratories comes from a paper from 1916, and the laboratories, most of them were built in the 60s, and that's before Jane Goodall went to the field. And the majority of chimpanzees are still living in cages that were designed by Robert Yerkes, who had never seen a wild chimpanzee, and Jane Goodall had never been to the field yet. We didn't know that they needed 4,000 football fields in the wild. And so these cages are completely outdated, and the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has not invested in improving the majority of cages because they see the writing on the wall that this is an obsolete resource, and they're not going to be breeding more chimpanzees. Got a few researchers remaining, and I think if we can just get this act passed, it's going to do great things, not just for research, because we're going to have more money to do much more harder hitting research, and we're also going to be helping our closest relative that is, you know, certainly imperiled in the wild, and it's going to send a very strong message to our African colleagues, saying that, you know, the commercial use of these animals is really just not appropriate.
And we have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, but you mentioned the fact that the chimps are being sold, and I guess legally sold as pets in the United States. How many people are keeping chimpanzees as pets? Does anyone know?
Yes. So Steve Ross at the Lincoln Park Zoo runs a website called Chimp Care, and you can go learn all about the problem there. There are up to 300 pet chimpanzees in the United States. And unfortunately, there are still a couple of people who breed chimpanzees. And although the United States Fish and Wildlife Service does a great job making sure no animals are smuggled into the United States, we can't say for sure that none come from Africa. And then number two is we know that they're getting smuggled into Europe from Africa and to the Middle East and into Russia. And so the bigger problem is that not only are there people in the United States who have pet chimpanzees, and I think we all heard about Travis, the chimpanzee, who unfortunately really severely injured Carla Nash, and she had her entire face had to be transplanted. And so having a pet chimpanzee that can weigh 180 pounds and be as strong as a lion and as smart as a 7-year-old child, you're dealing with trouble. And, of course, they have the temperament of a 2-year-old, so that's not a good combination.
Indeed.
And the real problem is that there are people still using chimpanzees in commercials, and they're using them in movies and in Super Bowl ads, et cetera. And what they do is they take 2 to 5-year-old infant chimpanzees, they take them away from their mothers, they use very aversive training techniques, and just taking them away from their mother alone is aversive. And then they create these advertisements, you know, for, you know, companies like Career Builder or has historically used these types of advertisements, and there are other companies as well that you know, it's to be funny. They dress chimpanzees up like people, but it's not funny, because what we have a paper that was just released in the journal PLOS One, and what we've demonstrated is that when people see these commercials, they think that chimpanzees are not endangered, they think that they make great pets, and they are much less likely to donate to a conservation cause to benefit chimpanzees. So the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act does more than save us money, promote science, and protect chimps. It also ends and protects United States citizens from being attacked by chimpanzees.
I hear you. Brian, we got to call a halt to our conversation, and that's Brian Hare, professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University Center for Cognitive Neuroscience. Stay with us. We're going to talk about something else after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The music of Sir Edward Elgar could inspire the empire. Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra present Elgar's Enigma Variations. Also, Robert Schumann's Cello Concerto with Gautier Capucin. Tickets online, philorc.org. By phone, 215-893-1999. October 28th and 29th at the Kimmel Center, Elgar's Enigma Variations with Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moscoen, here to remind you that your support is vital to the health and future of WHYY. We get about half of our operating funds from you, and we thank you for your support. If you have never been a supporter, do so now. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. We cover just about everything on Radio Times, and today it's the Great Ape Show. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Philadelphia College of Pharmacy at University of the Sciences is the nation's first educational institution to teach pharmacy and offers a direct entry admission option that allows students to earn a Doctor of Pharmacy in 6 years. Since 1821, the college has been preparing professionals in pharmacy practice, science, and healthcare. A blend of science and patient care, pharmacy is a challenging and fulfilling profession. Connect with Philadelphia College of Pharmacy at usciences.edu/pharmacy.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The discovery of fossil bones nearly 2 million years old in South Africa is shedding some light on and raising some questions about human evolution. The journal Science featured 5 studies on Australopithecus sediba, which has some unusual features. We asked Steve Churchill to join us to describe what all the fuss is about. He's an associate professor of anthropology at Duke University, a member of the team studying these fossils. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome. This actually goes back to 2008 when these fossil bones were found. First of all, where were they found in South Africa, and what exactly was found there?
Yeah, so they come from a site called Malapa, which is just outside of Johannesburg. And our team had been doing some survey work in that area, and my colleague Lee Berger went out there with his 9-year-old son and a postdoctoral student. And while he and the postdoc were talking about how they were going to systematically explore the area, he told his son to, you know, just go look for some fossils. They also had the family dog along, and apparently the dog ran off into the bush, and Matthew Berger, the 9-year-old, followed him and came back a few minutes later and said, "Dad, I found a fossil."
Really?
And yeah, Matthew's very good at finding fossils. He's been accompanying his dad for a long time, so he knows what to look for, you know. But he handed Lee a block, and Lee instantly recognized that there was a human collarbone in the block, and he turned it over, and there was a portion of a lower jaw, a human lower jaw, sticking out of the block. So the site was discovered by this 9-year-old. Well, we knew the site was there, but he found the first fossils. Yeah.
Well, I feel movie built around this particular discovery. But we're talking about something like 220 bones, maybe 5 individuals. Is that correct?
Yeah, the site is really remarkable. We have 2 partial skeletons, a juvenile male who was about maybe 11 to 13 in modern human terms at the time that he died, and an adult female. And those are both represented by partial skeletons, and then we have bits of other individuals. We now think we're up to about 6 individuals at the site.
And how old are these fossils?
So they're very precisely dated to about 1.98 million years ago. That's a really interesting time for us because, you know, first off, it's a time when the so-called ape men, the Australopiths, are starting to disappear from the fossil record, and the first true humans, the first members of our genus, the genus Homo, are starting to appear. And it's also a time where the fossil record is kind of scrappy in that little window, and there's a lot of questions about what species was ancestral to the first members of our genus, and sort of who the players are and how they're related to one another.
Well, let's talk about this find and I guess some of the significance. One is that it seems to have long fingers. What's the significance of that?
So the interesting thing about the hand is that, excuse me, the fingers are not especially long. They're not as long as you might see in a chimpanzee or you might see in an earlier Australopith. In fact, they're reduced a bit and the thumb is relatively long. And what that allows is for a tip-to-tip kind of precision grip, the kind of thing that we do every day when we're manipulating fine objects like a pencil or pen or a pair of chopsticks or something like that. Apes can't do that, and that sort of limits the kind of fine manipulation that apes can do. And this looks like the first time that we're seeing in the human fossil record this ability, and we think that it means, you know, more facility for making and using tools
and making stone tools.
Now, what's significant about the brain?
Well, the brain is very small. So in a lot of ways, Australopithecus sediba is very ape-like, and it has an ape-sized brain, the same sort of brain size that you would see in a chimpanzee or a gorilla. But the brain is starting to reorganize a little bit. We're starting to see some of the asymmetries that we see in our brains. And that tells us that in human evolution, the reorganization of the brain preceded the expansion of the size of the brain. We're not entirely sure what that means, but we suspect that it has something to do with this finer manipulative ability.
Interesting. As we take this body apart now, I was reading that the ankle joint looks like a human ankle joint?
Well, the foot is very complicated, and we're still sort of trying to figure it out. The ankle joint itself, you know, between the bone of the lower leg, the tibia, and the first ankle bone, the talus, is very modern looking. And had we only found that part of the joint, we would say, well, this is a member of our genus. This is, you know, this is a true human. But the bone right below it, the calcaneus, or the heel bone, is very primitive looking. And had we found that by itself, we would have said, wow, we're not even sure this is a human ancestor. This looks like some sort of chimpanzee or something. So we're seeing this throughout the skeleton, that these guys are a very interesting mix of very primitive traits on one hand and very derived traits on the other hand. And we're not entirely sure what that means about how they're walking on that foot.
And the pelvis also is significant.
Yeah, the pelvis is very interesting because it is much more like our pelvis than it is like the pelvis of other Australopiths. There are a couple of specimens of Australopithecus, earlier Australopithecus, that have relatively complete pelvis. The very famous fossil Lucy is one of those. And there are some big differences in the overall shape of the pelvis and the flaring of the hip bones and that kind of thing between Lucy and us. Sediba looks a lot more like us. We used to think that was because as brain sizes expanded in the genus Homo, the pelvis had to change its shape to accommodate for larger brain babies that had to be passed through the birth canal. But here we're seeing these changes before brain size is expanding. You know, this is a small brain species, yet it has a pelvis which is much more like ours. And that suggests instead that it is also reflecting some kind of change in the way that they're walking bipedally, that perhaps they're doing more of the kind of striding bipedal walking that you or I do, rather than the kind of walking on a bent hip, bent knee that a chimpanzee might do.
And that's Steve Churchill. He's an associate professor of anthropology at Duke University, part of a team studying some fossils that were found in South Africa a couple of years ago. They have made news. The journal Science featured 5 studies on Australopithecus sediba, as it is called, and we're talking about the unusual features, what it may say, or the questions it raises about human evolution. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So here's a very unscientifically phrased question. Could this be considered a missing link as we try to understand our evolution from our ancestors?
Well, you'll find that anthropologists really don't like the term missing link.
I figured.
It's kind of a Victorian era concept. And the thing is that we have a very rich human fossil record. There are periods where the record is not as good, and, you know, it's a bit more spotty and patchy, but overall we have a very, very good record. And what we find is that as we find new species, that the human family tree looks bushier and bushier, and it becomes increasingly complicated to try to figure out who's related to who and to draw nice lines between different species. But the reality is nature's just very messy, and nature really doesn't care about our desire to be able to fit things into nice little bins and draw nice straight lines between different groups. So it's a bit of a challenge to try to figure these things out. So I wouldn't call it a missing link, but it is clearly a very transitional sort of form, because in many ways it is very primitive. These guys were about the size of chimpanzees. They had small brains. They had very long upper limbs. have a lot of features in the skeleton which make it look like they're still doing a lot of tree climbing.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it has a lot of features that you only see in our genus, like this more modern-shaped pelvis, this reorganization of the brain, a reduction in the size of the teeth and the chewing muscles, this hand which is better able to do fine manipulation. So it really does look like it's something smack between the ape men or the Australopiths and true humans.
Does it also raise questions about the role, I guess, of the brain in human evolution and looking at a relatively small brain in these fossils, but also seeing some features that have human appearances?
It really does raise some questions. We don't know how much neural organization matters relative to brain size. Brains are very, very expensive. You know, we spend something like 25 or 30% of our daily calories in running our brains. And they're very expensive to grow, too, in children. They're metabolically, energetically, very, very costly. So we have to imagine that bigger brains must really do something for you to outweigh the costs of growing them. But what's less clear is how important the reorganization is. And I think we're sort of a long way from understanding that. There might be neuroscientists who have a much better idea about this than I do, but it does raise those kinds of interesting questions.
And is this a big deal in the world that you live in?
It is. It is a big deal, and it's been really fun. It's been fun to see all of my colleagues responding and commenting to these skeletons in the papers. Paleoanthropology is very contentious, and that's a good thing because science should be about, you know, debating things in a collegial way, but debating things and not accepting anything on face value and sort of demanding good analyses and good evidence. And we've made some pretty remarkable claims about these guys. You know, we're claiming that these guys are probably the direct ancestor of the first human species that everyone would recognize as being on our lineage, and that's Homo erectus. And that kind of pushes some other contenders to the side, and a lot of people don't like that. So it's been fun. And what's really important is whether we're right or not, these fossils are kind of forcing everybody to re-examine their assumptions, to re-examine the evidence, and it's just stimulating a whole lot of discussion and new research, and that's just wonderful to be a part of that.
And just so our listeners understand, you're saying that this find is thought to be the first sign of a human species?
Well, so we have put it in the genus Australopithecus, which means that we have lumped it in with the earlier ape men. And we did that because it does have so many primitive features, like the long arms and the small brain and the small body size. But our argument is that this is the ape man that gave rise to true humans.
Hmm. And who got pushed to the side?
So Homo habilis, which is was found by Louis Leakey back in the 1960s, would get pushed to the side. And there's another species that most people haven't heard about called Homo rudolfensis, which also looks increasingly like a side branch. That is if we're right. We're definitely the minority opinion on this, but...
So the question, and I guess this is what evolutionary anthropologists fight about or debate?
Yeah, evolutionary anthropology studies humans from a biological perspective, and we study everything about humans. So my field, the study of the human fossil record, is just a piece of evolutionary anthropology overall, but we study human biology and human anatomy and primate behavior and all sorts of things like that.
And that is Steve Churchill, and he is an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. We are talking about a find in South Africa, a find of fossil bones almost 2 million years old, Australopithecus sediba, and that's gotten the world of evolutionary anthropologists all excited, and we're talking about what the fuss is about. 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And good morning. I'm Susan Greenbaum, one of the producers of Radio Times, here with Liz Fiedler, one of our reporters at WHYY. Well, that was fun. Who but Marty could spend an hour talking about chimps in a very scientific way and just bring it to life? That's what we do here on Radio Times. We take you behind the headlines. We give you an opportunity to think and learn about something you might not otherwise have time to learn about. Chimpanzees. Fascinating. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. If you're one of our regular listeners to Radio Times, perhaps you tune in every now and then. This is your time to show us that you really care what we do here. 1-888-345-9499.
And this is one show, Susan, that going into great. It, I knew so little about, and I was so sucked in. There was the part where they were talking about the 9-year-old boy who, with his dog, found this important fossil. And then there was another great moment where Marty said, you know, she just sort of laid it out there. She said, this is not the correct scientific wording, but is this, you know, the missing link that we're looking for? I love how Marty asks these questions that often questions that are on my mind and often questions that after she says it, I think, That's a great question. You know, I'm glad that she was listening to what that person said and followed up on it. She does such a wonderful job. That's why you're listening. That's why you tune into Radio Times. That's why you put it on your schedule to put on your headphones at work or to turn on the radio at home. Give us a call now and let us know that you value Radio Times, that it is an important part of your life. 1-888-345-9499 or go online to whyy.org. Again, the phone number 1-888-345-9499. And Susan, I know you've had some favorite shows recently
we were
talking about.
You know, I was just thinking about how, you know, we have an hour-long format. And this is a rare opportunity to help you, our listeners, understand issues, but really get to hear and talk to the people who are really shaping the way we're thinking these days. In recent weeks, we've had National Book Award winner Stephen Greenblatt, Russell Banks, the author Russell Banks was in here last week. He's the guy who got my son to read. A couple weeks ago, we spoke to MacArthur Genius Award winner Jacob Saul. He's a local guy. He teaches at Rutgers. He lives in West Philly. And very intellectual stuff, but he brought to life his passion for his field of research, which is about the history of accounting, all that sort of stuff. And when we read about it, we thought, but he was so alive and so passionate, and he told wonderful stories about how his life as an intellect has evolved. These are the kinds of conversations we bring you day in and day out. Please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-9499. To become a member of WHYY and make this programming possible. You know, we talked about podcasts, Liz, before. They're free, and I confess, I don't always get to listen to our shows, but I do listen to our podcasts.
I also, I often find myself turning on WHYY at night. If I haven't heard Radio Times in the morning, I listen to the rebroadcast.